All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Tuesday, January 26th, 2021. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other radio programs I've participated in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all the details. All right, with that said, let me introduce our special guest this evening. Warren Balog is joining us for the very first time. Warren is one of the founding members of the National Justice Party. Warren, welcome to the program, sir. How are you?
I'm great, John. Great to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's been a while. We were actually just talking before we started recording how we actually met at the Fall 2015 NPI conference, which is a long time ago now. Very interesting conference, though, at the time, for sure. And this was the one right before the whole Hailgate controversy, so I missed out on that one. But it was good to meet you. It's been a while, and I guess I didn't connect the dots and realize that you were also the commenter known as Ahab. And yeah,
you so know I'm, what? Yeah, at that time I didn't start using the name Ahab until I guess it was 2017, I think. Yeah, it was 2017 that I started writing for altright.com under Ahab. So I wasn't at that time. But yeah, that's funny. We were talking about it. 2015 NPI was a very special one because if you've been to the ones before that, it was a lot of the same old characters. I mean, some new people, but for the most part, a lot of people who had been in the white nationalist movement for a while. 2015 was the one where all of a sudden there was this explosion of young people. With all these fashy haircuts, and it was really something big. I mean, I had not years in the white nationalist movement and my father and everything. I had never seen anything like that. All these new people flooding into it. So yeah, that was an exciting time. That was a good NPI.
Yeah, it was, and it was also shortly after President Trump, or I guess former President Trump, stepped foot on the political stage and announced his candidacy and was making headlines and generating a lot of very enthusiastic support, you know, especially from guys like us, people that were in the alt-right at the time. And so that was a major topic at that conference, and it's something we'll get into here in this conversation as well. But just to get started, can you kind of introduce yourself and give us some background on how you got involved in all this? I know you've been affiliated with the Right Stuff and the National Justice Party, and you're often a guest on some of their live streams and stuff like that. So you want to just kind of start out and give us a brief intro?
Yeah, sure. I basically was kind of raised in the movement, not really actively, but my dad was an activist with William Pearson, the National Alliance, back in the 70s, and before that was with the National Socialist White People's Party, which was the successor or rebranded American Nazi Party. So dad joined up with them post-Rockwell, but was with them for a number of years and then was with Pierce and the Alliance early on. And then he sort of dropped out of politics when I was a kid. And then in high school, I kind of got into it myself because I took a real strong interest in history and politics. And I had many, many interesting discussions with my father because I was getting one perspective in school at the time. It was very liberal in the 90s. A lot of just Holocaust, Schindler's List and slavery and, you know, it was the Clinton years, and there had some very liberal high school teachers who were well-meaning people. But that kind of awakened in me an interest in these things because it was so different from what I knew my dad believed in. And because of his past, I had access to a lot of great books that I dove into and then kind of red-pilled myself on a lot of these things like the Second World War and many other issues. And I just found politics incredibly interesting. I mean, I became very, very interested in history and in politics. And I saw all these bad things happening in the world and I wanted to get involved. So from then on, I've done a lot of work with political parties. I was with the Reform Party after Pat Buchanan for a while. I was even in the West Virginia Democratic Party, active for a while in college. Kind of stayed away from overt white nationalist organizations because I had seen growing up a lot of dysfunction and infighting and just sort of, they were very marginalized. I didn't want to just take that road. I wanted to try to work within the system and do something more just directly political. But after about 2010, I kind of entered the political wilderness myself because it was just a really weird time. The Tea Party was the thing, and it was completely like astroturfed, and the white nationalism, there weren't any, a lot of the big leading figures who were great thinkers like William Pierce were gone. There was this sort of limbo, and there wasn't really anything new happening. But then it was around 2013 that I became involved. I took an interest in what was happening with what would become the alt-right, writers like Tom Sunnick and people like that, and Kevin MacDonald. And then 2014, my dad and I both went to Budapest for Richard Spencer's aborted conference that he tried to have there. And I met all these amazing people. And that's when I really got active with the alt-right after that. And then 2015 and 2016, 2017, I was at Charlottesville, you know, Pikeville. I was involved with IE for a while. And since then, I've stayed very, very, very active and got involved with the right stuff. Well, pool party. It was a great local pool party I got pretty active with. And then through that, met some great guys. And recently, I was actually the one who put together the seven-man committee to form the National Justice Party, because it's something that I just felt the time was right, that we had the right people for it, and especially after the failure of some of the efforts that came out of the alt-right post-Charlottesville and some of the organizations that failed, like the TWP and IE, I felt like it's time for something new, and I felt like I finally had the right guys to put together for this thing. And the right man to lead it, which is Mike Enoch, Mike Painovich, who's a dear friend of mine and a guy I respect tremendously. So, yes. So yeah, that's where we are now. And, I'm, like I said, I'm really excited right now. Today, in fact, by the time this podcast is released, if you still haven't seen it, go to the website, nationaljusticeparty.com, and check out Mike's speech that we just recorded this past Saturday, responding to all the craziness that has happened since the 6th of January, and up through the Biden inauguration and all the extreme outrages that the government and the media are engaging in. We put together a kind of an impromptu meeting because we felt that the outrages right now from the government and the media are so extreme, and no one, not Donald Trump, no one else on the right was properly responding to this. We felt it was important enough to put together an event and have a speech. So we put this event together in about a week, which is, it's hard to get like a big audience together in that length of time. Usually it takes more time to prepare, but we did. And, Mike gave a hell of a speech, and I feel like he really said what needs to be said. I wish we could get every Trump supporter to hear what he said about the event. So if you haven't seen that speech, check it out, because it was a really good one.
Yeah, no, I bet most of his speeches are excellent and worth listening to for sure. I had about two or three different people either text me or DM me that speech today, and I just haven't even had a chance to listen to it myself, but I certainly do plan on doing that. And I want to get more into the National Justice Party, because it's interesting. I mean, you said prior to really getting involved in the alt-right, you were kind of trying to work in like mainstream politics and almost, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but almost like distance yourself from like explicitly pro-white organizations or political parties. And now the National Justice Party is, I think you could say, an explicitly pro-white, you know, political party, which I think is exactly what needs to happen if we're really going to make any progress anywhere politically. Before we do that, I got to ask you, I mean, you definitely sound like a very smart guy. I follow you on Telegram. You got a lot of good takes. I've read a bunch of your articles in the past, and I know you're a very brilliant guy. So I got to ask you, what are some of the most influential thinkers or books that you've read over the years? And I know this is kind of a big question, but if you want to maybe keep it to three or four or something, just the ones that stand out and maybe have had the most influence on you.
Well, I am, people who know me well know I'm pretty much an orthodox Hitlerist, in that I am someone who really, I feel that Hitler is by far the greatest thinker and leader that our movement has produced, our civilization has produced in the last, 100 years at least. By far my first, second, third, and fourth biggest influence. I'm someone, though, that I don't see Hitler as a sort of cult figure. I don't see him as like a pseudo-religious figure. I also don't see him as a guy who is tainted that we have to sort of distance ourselves from. I just see him as a brilliant political thinker and leader. And I've studied Hitler and his writings in the Third Reich extensively to the point where I could teach like a college course on it. And I love to spurg out about it. It's a fun thing. Some people enjoy that and some people don't. But I feel that the experiences that movement and the other interwar fascist movements had, if I want to connect that to our current time, I'll just put it this way. The 19th century saw this enormous transformation in Europe and in America, in the West, of the Industrial Revolution and the growth of this gigantic forces of industrial capitalism. And it also saw an explosion of population because of the increased, productive capacity of the Industrial Revolution. Socialism is something that came out of that as a response to that because of the enormous abuses of industrial capitalism. Socialism was something that was already starting in European peoples in one form or another, in an organic form, in a non-Jewish form, if I can just, call a spade, before Marxism came along and sort of hijacked it and turned it into an internationalist, atheistic. Marxism came along and basically piggybacked on the legitimate grievances of workers. Like, I live in the Rust Belt, and I was just reading the other day about the conditions of the workers in the factories where I live. 8-hour day, forget about it. You'd be lucky if you had a 12-hour day. And it was just brutal, unsafe working conditions, just brutal, long hours. And the exploitation of the people and of the land, which is really the history of the Industrial Revolution in the United States. Socialism was something that came organically from the Europeans, but it was hijacked by Marxism. I feel like what the battle that took place then in the early 20th century between capitalism and sort of the reactionary old forces of wealth and money and power and privilege versus this new up-and-coming communist force that was just threatening to overturn European civilization. The answer to that was found by the young soldiers after the First World War, who got out of the war filled with patriotism, filled with love of fatherland and of family and, respect for the institutions like the military and of the nation. I mean, real true nationalists. But they were also not for maintaining the privilege and wealth of the extreme capitalists or of the old aristocracies that had grown very corrupt. And these guys formed what were the budding fascist movements. And it was not just one. It wasn't just Hitler. It wasn't just Mussolini. There was one pretty much in every country in Europe. And even in the United States, there were movements that were very similar to this. Huey Long and the Share Our Wealth movement and Father Coughlin, they weren't organized in that militant form that you had in the European countries, which was largely a response to the civil war-like conditions that existed in Germany and Italy and other places, and certainly in Russia, there was a civil war. But I feel like, John, that we are in a kind of similar time in that the ravages of capitalism are today really just terrible. The concentration of wealth at the top is as bad as it has been in our lifetimes and in our parents' lifetimes. I mean, the baby boomers never experienced this type of plutocracy, this concentration of wealth, and this total domination of the economy by large corporations. It harkens back to the Gilded Age. And just like then, you have these essentially communists, Bolsheviks, coming along trying to sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater. So you have people like Bernie Sanders or AOC, who aren't really, I mean, they're not communists. They are socially. But they are trying to piggyback on the legitimate grievances of working people in this country. Onto that, they're trying to add all this terrible anti-tradition, anti-white, anti-family, you know, LGBTQ, tranny, trans rights, you know, Black Lives Matter, Antifa violence, ripping down the statues of our forefathers, brainwashing our kids in the schools. They're trying to jam all that in with their legitimate critique of the excesses of capitalism. So I feel like we are in a time that is very similar to the time that the original fascists came out of. And fascism, of course, you know, it's a scary word, but what it was basically was a form of right-wing socialism, a national socialism, a socialism of the nation that affirms the family, that affirms tradition, that affirms traditional religion, traditional morality, that affirms the military virtues. But it's still a socialism in that it's for the people and for the working people of the country, and it fights against this, these giant capitalist abuses. So by far my biggest influence is Hitler and the National Socialists, and then along with them all the other European interwar fascists. I'm a big admirer of Mussolini and what he did. I'm a big admirer of all the different ones. Because my name is Hungarian, I've into the Hungarian history, Ferenc Szálasi and the Arrow Cross Party in Hungary and others. But then, like I said, also in the United States, I would have to say Father Coughlin is my favorite figure from that period. So I'm very much a man influenced by the thinkers and the writings of the 20s and the 30s.
Very cool, man. Well, that was such an epic answer, especially your comments on Hitler, because I've been saying for a long time, I mean, it's just objectively true that he clearly was the most important and the most righteous and honorable leader and thinker in Western history, certainly in modern Western history. And I don't think that that's wrong or bad optics to say that out loud and to organize around that principle, because, I mean, if you think about what he did, what he stood for, if you read Mein Kampf and just look at everything that he said, I mean, what is there to disagree with? He had this all figured out to a T and explained it concisely and powerfully to people.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's also, I mean, Hitler has become, I've said this before on podcasts, but Hitler has become a sort of stand-in for, I mean, there's nobody worse than Hitler. I mean, Satan is not worse than Hitler. You know, Hitler is demonized to the point where he's like a supernatural force. And I really feel like as a people, we haven't actually progressed that far from the Middle Ages. Like we have smartphones now, but as far as our basic mass psychology, we're still basically like a lot of people are still pretty much like medieval peasants in the way they interpret the world. So, for instance, I'll give you an example, like this Russia conspiracy stuff. You have a lot of affluent, liberal, boomer cat ladies that sincerely believe, for a period there, till the media told them to stop doing it, sincerely believe that, like, anything, any post they see online that doesn't jive with their worldview is somehow Vladimir Putin influencing them. And this is a very, it's like a kind of medieval superstition. It's like, you know, you see demons all around you and devils. I feel like the way Hitler is portrayed in the West, it's occupying the same space that the devil did in our medieval group consciousness. And that's quite an accomplishment of you know, I'm a big student of propaganda and of public relations and of the history of public relations and mass communication, mass propaganda techniques. And this has just been a big lie, the biggest of big lies, has been repeated decade after decade after decade. And it's one of these things that it feeds on itself. And it's kind of, it grows with the legend, just how evil Hitler was and how just incomprehensibly, like, bad and just, and it's one of those things that it completely shuts down people's ability to think objectively. But if you study the man, I mean, he was at the very least, he was like a good, well-meaning person. He was an honest man who patriotically served his country, who felt for, you know, starving German women and kids that were being blockaded, who wanted to raise his country up. And many, many, many people have said this outside the West. Many, many people have said it. And, of course, you know, we all know the famous John Kennedy quote, what he said.
John F. Kennedy said it himself. Yeah, in his diary.
His diary, his wartime diary, he said, because he visited the sites where Hitler was, and he said that there was just something about this man. He said that there's a mystery about him and the way he lived and the manner of his death. The legend will grow on after him. He said he had in him the stuff of which legends are made, that he was just so just great. So, yeah, it's something that this enormous cloud of, like, dark energy that people put around Hitler, where Hitler's, you know, just the blackest, darkest, most evil thing that you can even think about, is to prevent people from looking. If you don't have that cloud, if Hitler becomes like Napoleon, where you can actually have you can have historians debate, okay, was Napoleon, you know, a mass murderer? Was Napoleon responsible for all these terrible wars? Or was Napoleon a great military and political leader who was very advanced for his time? He did a lot for France. He did a lot for Europe. And you can have this like sort of debate about it. But the thing is, Napoleon is not really that relevant right now to the time that we're living in, because his time was the pre-industrial, the age of European empires. We're living in a completely different era. But the politics of Hitler's day, as I said earlier, are extremely relevant to today. The same people Hitler was fighting against are the people running this country and running the world. In fact, the whole post-war world order is a post-Hitler order. It's an order of, who sits on the United Nations Security Council, how the power is divided up in the world, is specifically founded on the ruins of the Third Reich and of that war. So you have a situation where pretty much anyone in the world, or certainly in the West, who holds power has an interest in maintaining this Hitler myth and the World War II myth in general and the Holocaust myth. So that's why they have to maintain this. This is just the ultimate evil. If you even begin to start ask questions, I saw a thing recently. I posted on my Twitter. There was some, Republican candidate who she was a freshman senator or congresswoman. She was trying to make a point about something else, not to do with Nazis or Jews or Hitler. But she said, you know, one thing Hitler was right about is that you have to get to the young people first, because if you win over the young people, then you win over the country. And maybe she was even saying this, like, this is bad that Hitler said that. But she said the phrase, like, one thing Hitler was right about, and oh my goodness.
No, those were the headlines, yeah, and everybody's denouncing her.
Hitler went nuts, and Jonathan Greenblatt came out, and he actually tweeted, he said, Hitler wasn't right about anything. And I thought, you know, that's kind of funny, because, I mean, I'm a vegetarian, not because of Hitler, but I happen to be a vegetarian. I was a vegetarian 25 years ago, even before I got into Hitler. So it's like, was Hitler right about vegetarianism? Are you going to tell all those vegetarians that they're like Hitler? I mean, was Hitler, you know, he favored Mercedes. Like, are Mercedes drivers, you know, like, I mean, Hitler wasn't right about anything. That's Jonathan Greenblatt's statement. Because if you acknowledge even one human quality about the man, the whole thing starts to unravel. And then with it, the entire rationale for the current political order that rules the world, you know?
Yeah, so exactly.
This isn't just let me just say, the last point. This isn't just about maintaining the amount of reparations that Germany pays to Israel. Like, a lot of people think that's what the Holocaust myth, maintaining that myth, is about. That it's like, okay, well, Israel wouldn't get all these benefits if it wasn't for that. No, it's even China and Russia recently, who are, you know, based Russia, right? They recently issued a joint statement in opposition to any attempts of historical revisionism when it comes to who were the good guys and bad guys in World War II. And why? Because if Russia, so much of Russia's geopolitical, you know, where they are in the world, their position is legitimized by the good guy, bad guy thing of that war. And the same is true of China. So if, in other words, if you are China and you acknowledge that maybe Hitler wasn't bad, or maybe that wasn't a battle between good and evil, then now suddenly Japan has a lot of legitimate grievances maybe, or demands that they were going to make. So that's what I'm saying. Even countries that are not aligned with the U.S., like China and Russia, have a stake in making sure that the narrative of World War II is not questioned. So if that's true of China and Russia, imagine how much more true it is for France, England, and the United States, let alone like the fake puppet governments of somebody like Angela Merkel in Germany.
Yeah, very well said. I mean, I think the whole entire anti-white, the white genocide agenda, let's call it really what it is. I mean, all the policies being implemented across the entire Western world, especially America now. I mean, these are policies designed to destroy traditional white Western, formerly Christian countries, to fundamentally displace the people that founded these countries, and to disenfranchise them politically. And it's all based on the official narrative of World War II, at least at its heart, that's the main paradigm all of this revolves around.
Yes,
and there's no getting around that. I mean,
right?
There's and this has been a huge point of contention, and like a there's been a debate raging. Not so much lately, but I remember reading people arguing that this is something that we can kind of step over as white nationalists, and we don't need to even address revisionism or World War II, or Hitler for that matter. And I've always vehemently disagreed with this perspective, because all of this goes back to World War II, what Hitler stood for, and what the globalists and the Jews ultimately defeated, paving the way for this globalist, communist, capitalist, it's like a little bit
it's
a
like
mixture
a
of both. Yeah, it's
synthesis.
Like,
yeah,
it is,
funny,
it basically is.
Third positionism, we joke third positionism is sort of like a nice way of saying National Socialism, but what's funny is the enemy is sort of third positionist as well. Like Kamala Harris, for instance, who I think is the person that the system wants as president and is going to have as president very shortly. Kamala Harris is a good sort of a representative in her career and her worldview and the people who back her of their version, the enemy's version of third positionism. They are borrowing the worst big corporate domination of the old industrial capitalists that I was talking about, the robber barons. So like Jeff Bezos is like the worst of the robber barons. In a lot of respects, they're borrowing that aspect of international capitalism. So none of the pro-worker stuff, none of the stuff from the communists, but this thing they are taking from the communists is their social ideology. So, a horribly, just corrosive, destructive, anti-social worldview that's just bound to break down, like I say, families and communities, nations and races. So they have their own form of third positionism where they take the social aspects of Bolshevism and then mix it with the most ruthless capitalist methods. And we have our version of third positionism, which is we take all the best pro-worker stuff of socialism and then all the nation-building strengths of nationalism and combine them. But it's really, it is. And this has been the case for many years, for decades, as far as when you talk about third positionism. They used to talk about what was Bill Clinton, the phrase, and Tony Blair. It was like the third way or something like that, where I forget the phrase that they used, but it's basically a mixed economy where you're blending some aspects of heavy state control with some aspects of a free market. And this mixed economy model is really the only model you can have work as a modern state. You have to have some form of mixed economy. You can't just have an open free market where it's just everything is willy-nilly, let the market decide. And you also, an economy can't run if it's just everything is command economy, top down from the state. The state's telling you how many loaves of bread you need to have on your shelf. So you see even China going to a mixed economy model, a form of like a mix of capitalism and socialism. And so is this economy, because this economy has tons of heavy-handed state control, corporate welfare even. But it's not just what the fact that you're mixing capitalism and socialism. It's what end is it serving? Who is it serving? For whose benefit is it? What are your values when you're, you know, creating this mix? And that's the thing, is that this mixture of Bolshevism, like Bolshevist social values with extreme capitalist economic methods that we have in this country, primarily benefits the Jews, the Jewish, you know, elite, and also all their, like, this crony class of just, you know, professional traitors to their own people, whether they're whites or blacks, like somebody like Barack Obama. And then also, it hurts the great mass of white people that make up the backbone of this country. They are the ones that it hurts more than anybody else. And it doesn't really help the blacks that are here. It doesn't really help the Hispanics that are here. It doesn't even help the Asians that are here. But it really, really hurts the great white majority. So that's what this is about. I mean, what we're trying to do with the National Justice Party is, what we're pushing for is, we want to have a mixed economy too, but basically the flip it around, the opposite of what they have. Instead of it benefiting this tiny Jewish minority, we want it to benefit the vast majority of whites, and then also with fairness to the other people that are here. And we want to rein in the power of this destructive capitalism, this huge, just world-changing. I mean, you see it with big tech. Jeff Bezos is looking now to buy CNN, in addition to owning the Washington Post, in addition to cleaning up with the COVID for Amazon. We want to rein that capital, the power of big capital, in international capital, give more help to small businesses, give more help to nationally based industries. And it's not just global capital, but at the same time, put a stop to all these destructive social values and rebuild communities and rebuild the family. So it's, you know, that's really what the whole struggle is about.
Right. Well, hey, sign me up. And you know what? I think most people, if they had somebody break this down to them, how would you not agree with this, these sort of basic tenets, this sort of basic platform? And I will have a link over to the National Justice Party's platform. It's right on your website, nationaljusticeparty.com. Real quick, you kind of briefly addressed in the intro the origin of the party. It hasn't even been a year since it was initially founded, correct?
That's right. Yeah, it was, I believe, our first meeting where we all sat down together was the 13th of June of last year.
Okay, so this only recently came into fruition. Do you want to kind of briefly talk about its origins? You had mentioned, you know, you guys kind of all came together and had the right group of guys to kind of kickstart this. Did you guys all sit down and kind of come up with a platform and develop a strategy?
We did. Yeah, we sat down over 2 days in an Airbnb and just worked it all out between the seven of us, what we wanted to do, what we didn't want to do. You know, there's a couple of things that became obvious right off the bat. Every person that's involved with the National Justice Party, with the Central Committee that we formed, is someone who has had a lot of experience in this movement, and everyone was someone that had done it under their own name and under their own face, except for me, actually. I'm the one person that was still, I guess you could say, undoxed, although I had already been outed myself because I was involved with a lawsuit with Greg Conte, who's also a member of the National Justice Party's Central Committee, in suing the city of Charlottesville, because we were there at Charlottesville, Greg and I, and, you know, part of the same treatment that everybody got, you know, led into an ambush by the Virginia governor and the state police. So I was sort of out with that, but otherwise people didn't know I was going by this name Ahab. So part of this was because I wanted to do this, and I figure all these other guys are out there. Either they were doxxed or they guys like Tony Hovater have been operating under their own name from the beginning, which I have great respect for that. And I remember you too, John. You're somebody that's also put your name to your politics very, very early on, which I have a lot of respect for that.
Yeah, I never got the memo about creating like a pseudonym or anything like that.
You know what?
Well, and real quick, let me just say also, because this is something I did want to mention, and I think it's amazing that you guys are all doing this using your real names. I think that's very, very important. And at the end of the day, looking back on it, I wouldn't even change what I did, because I stand by what I believe in, and I'm not just like making up the stuff that I'm saying on my website. This is all stuff that is very, very well proven, well, you know, cited. It's not like these are some wild, crazy conspiracy theories that we're talking about here. We can document and back up everything we're saying about all of this stuff. So, I mean, at the end of the day, it's fundamentally that's what it's got to be. It's like, we're either going to just talk about this stuff on the internet or stick our necks out there and say this stuff publicly and say, look, this is not okay. What's going on? And here's why. And this is what we need to do about it.
It's about having, I mean, it's something that once I did it, I was sort of ashamed that it had taken me so long to do it. Once I did it, I felt like, because again, it's like, you know, I know all these things, and it was a lot easier for me than it would be for many people. And I don't, you know, I would never try to say, oh, you know, you're a bad person if you're not out there under your own name. I will say this though, that every white person that comes out with their true views and just openly says what they think, it weakens the power structure. This whole power structure thrives on making us feel like criminals or deviants for having totally normal, rational views. Even if they're not normal in the sense that they're not common, they're normal in that given the information that we have at our disposal, given what we know, these are normal conclusions that a lot of people would come to if they're fed the right information, if you strip away the lies. But yeah, I have nothing but respect for that. Like I said, I admired that about you, that you were always just, and that's, like I said, that's like Tony Hovater and a few others that I know who just never, ever even bothered with a pseudonym. And, you know, yeah, it can make life kind of tough, but it's very hard to starve to death in the United States. Like, you know, so far, anyway, maybe by another couple of summers of corona lockdowns, it'll be easier. But right now, you can pretty much find a way to eat, a way to survive, and it might make you stronger. You know, you can adapt and find you can find employers that don't care. You can find ways to survive. You can grow your own food. I mean, there's things you can do. And you know, if you're putting into this movement, there's enough people in this movement. People can, you know, kick a few shekels to keep you going. So it's something that, more of our people should do it.
I'll say this: it's challenging. It has been a challenge from the beginning, but it's something that is totally doable. You know,
yes.
it's not that you know, scary of a thing. I mean, you know, I think people make a bigger deal about it than you know ultimately what it is. I mean, yeah, you got to be careful. You got to be careful what you say. You got to be smart about what you're talking about and writing on the internet and stuff like that. But that should go without saying. And well, I think more than anything, it's about how you conduct yourself.
Yes. You see,
because you go and read real quick, you go and read like the article that came out when I was fired. I was working for a local city government, and you go read the article and like, they're quoting people that worked with me and they're like, oh yeah, John was great. Like, he was a good employee. Like, he never, you know, we had no idea he thought about this stuff and, you know, was a blogger and all this. So it's just, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is it's not that big a deal. And I think your conduct, at the end of the day, you'll work something out if you're smart and if you're an honorable person.
Yes. And that's what I was getting ready to say, is that there's two things in this, and we can then go back to talking about the party. But the two things about this, the one aspect of it is that it cuts down on the, I think having a double life is bad, in terms of you shouldn't be out there overdriving your headlights saying crazy radical things that if you had to just explain them to someone in person, you couldn't back them up, or you would feel embarrassed or ashamed that you had said them. And we saw a lot of that in 2016. You know, that was one problem with all the young kids that were getting involved with the alt-right, is that they were really, you know, a lot of like nerds and stuff like that who online, there's some sort of monstrous, you know, racist, and they enjoyed that. You know, there was a lot of ironic humor and a lot of fun, like triggering people and everything. We're way past that point, first of all, with this movement. I mean, things have gotten a lot more serious since then. But second, it's just, it's like, if you want to persuade people, you don't have to go to these ridiculous extremes. The internet can be good in that it can get your message out there. It can be bad because it can foster a kind of weird unreality. That's where you say these insane things that sound like, you know, for example, one big pet peeve of mine is people praising mass shooters. That's something that people do online sometimes under fake names. And it always is just like, it's either, I'm like, okay, either this is not a good, this is a bad actor, or this is someone who is so ridiculously immature that they don't belong in serious politics. I mean, we're talking about the real world. This isn't like Mortal Kombat where you can do like cool fatalities and, oh yeah, that's great. You know, wow, awesome. This is very real, what we're dealing with. So when you operate under your own name and face, it forces you to sort of watch your language and watch your manner. And you can talk about radical things. You can say Hitler was not a bad guy. That's a very radical thing to say. But you're not going to be, oh yeah, Hitler was cool because, you know, he killed all these people and, you know, hail Satan. I mean, come on. That's
right.
That's,
you know, well, it creates a sense of accountability.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. You have to back up. You have to have the courage of your convictions. You have to back up what you say, which means that the dialogue, I think, tends to get smarter and better and more mature. The other thing about it is that I think that the fear that people have of being outed as having politically incorrect views is actually something that is deep rooted in our pro-social, white rooted community. I don't know. It's in our blood. Because if you look at the Jews, for example, Jews have this thing called chutzpah. A lot of Jews, if you're ever around them, they can be very pushy, very aggressive. They sometimes don't seem to care what other people think of them. You see that a lot with Jews, and Jews can push and push and push and really be very aggressive with pushing their interests, or with sometimes just bold-faced lies or exaggerations. And they don't seem to have like a moral inhibition against it. And if you examine the history of the Jews, it makes sense. Jews were wanderers going from people to people to people. And when you're wanderers, it's the same thing with gypsies. You have to be good at just being sort of like a bullshit artist. You have to develop that skill set, and you have to kind of develop a thick skin for it. Like, you can't worry what people think about you. You have to just sort of brazenly, you know, tell your thing and say it with a sort of confidence, even if you don't even believe it. Say it with a confidence that people are just taken aback by what you say, and they just automatically go along with what you say. That's what chutzpah is, this sort of boldness. White people, on the other hand, have these elaborate codes of, I mustn't say this because that will give me a bad name in the community. And that's ancient, deep-rooted thing. It goes back to, if you are a settled people living in a specific community, in an area or tribe or whatever, your reputation was everything. Your reputation was everything. If you're a man, your reputation as a warrior, or as a hunter, you know, will you be a good comrade, brother to the other men in the tribe? Because if you're not, if you're a coward, then you are just like, you're a threat to the tribe because they can't trust you in a situation. And if you're a woman, it was your virtue. The fact that you are not a whore, because if you have a reputation for being someone who has modesty and has virtue, and you're saving yourself for a right guy, you're going to be a good match. Then your prospects of getting married would be better. But if you are known as a slut or a whore, somebody of bad character, this is going to doom your chances of finding a man and settling down and having a family, which was like life or death. So I feel like white people, and this is true of, you know, a lot of Asian cultures have this kind of thing of your reputation, Japanese certainly, but I think with white people, we have this thing where our social standing, our social reputation is still extremely important to us. And that there's like an irrational fear of losing that because, again, in our history as our ancestors, it was like life or death. If you would be exiled from the tribe as a white person, you know, you're gonna be alone in the wilderness. You're gonna die. So that's what it is, I think, with people, why they have this horror of being outed as like, oh, I'm someone that's like gonna be ostracized. And these Jews use that against us because they don't have that. They know how to brazenly push their chutzpah and just be like, oh, you're a white nationalist. You're a monster. You're a terrorist. When really it's like, who the hell are you to call me that? I'm talking about defending my community values that were standard even 10 years ago. You know, the stuff with gay marriage was normal, like to be opposed to gay marriage. That's like the normal view of a Democratic political candidate. They just so brazenly normalize the extreme abnormal. And that's what I'm saying. It's a weird thing. We have to kind of break out of that. And it takes people like you and me and like I said, Tony Ovid or Greg Conti, these wonderful guys I know that have just been like, okay, I don't give a fuck. I'm just going to say it, who and what I am. And I'm going to be the best neighbor, friend, father, husband that I can be. And I'm going to let my character, my good character, speak for itself. So even if you yes. question my, you know, and that's what helps defeat this massive, I don't know, this sort of mental, just this trap that our whole society is in, where what is good and healthy and normal is treated like it's some sort of deviant view or terrorism now. So yeah, it's very good to be open about it. Anyway, yeah. Went on a long digression there.
No, that's very good. I totally agree with you. And I think another thing that drives me, I'm sure it drives everybody that, you know, has come out and used their real name and you know, spoken out about these issues, is just what's going on, what we've seen historically, what we see now, today, is just so wrong. It's so fundamentally contrary to everything I stand for. And yes. I just can't sit around and act like, okay, you know, this is okay, or it's not that big of a deal, or, you know, maybe somebody else will speak out about it. I'll just go about my business. No, that's, I think this stuff is so important. It's worth sacrificing over. It's worth, I mean, even dying over at some point if it really came to that. I mean, what's going on in our country is just so wrong and evil, and I will not stand for it, frankly. I mean, you know, I will not sit around and just let it happen and not say anything about it or object to it or try to explain it to people, which is really all I've been trying to do, is just raise awareness of what's going on and seeing what we can do to get back on the right track, which seems like we're way off at this point.
Well, that's to bring this back to the National Justice Party. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to put stuff out there. Every man on that committee is a third positionist, or you could say a national socialist. You know, our worldview, there's no cracks in our worldview. We all have the same worldview. But at the same time, we want to actually get through to people. We're not here to play dress up. We're not here to be historical reenactors or try to, you know. And we're also here not here to pander. And this is, you know, a few years back, it really, thank God, it's finally gone. But in 2018, right after Charlottesville, there was this enormous split between this good optics crowd versus bad optics crowd, WigNat, AmNat. I mean, I feel like that stuff was seeded by our enemies, a lot of it, to cause infighting, because we were kind of down and out after Charlottesville. The movement was lost and confused. We didn't know. We were getting under constant attack, people getting doxxed left and right, their lives just getting really messed up. Lawsuits, people going to prison, and so the ground was fertile to create this sort of fight, this fake fight. And I call it a fake fight because I don't see it as being any actual difference. It's bad to go off in some direction with your presentation where you're just losing people. Because you are, like I said, you're just indulging either a historical reenactor, or you're playing dress up, or you're doing some kind of thing, or you're just acting extreme and antisocial, where you're just alienating normal people. You're acting like a cult. You're acting like a freak. You're just alienating normal people. You're offending them with your presence, with your appearance, with your language. That's bad. That's bad because we want to win people over. We want to persuade people to that what we're doing is right, and get them to see the truth of what's happening to their country and who's responsible. And we want to get them to change their views. So anything that impedes that ability to communicate with people and get through to them is bad. But by the same token, it's also bad to pander. You don't want to pander to people either, and you don't want to ingratiate yourself. I view like wrapping yourself in too much Americana and pretending to be to love like the Trump family, even when we all know Trump was controlled by Jews like Adelson and Kushner and just doing the bidding of Israel, to wrap yourself in the flag of Trumpism when you actually you're by your conscience and by your brain, you have real misgivings about where this is going and who's leading it. That's just trying to ingratiate yourself to people. It's lying to them. It's telling them sweet little white lies to try to get in with them. And you're trying to trick them into following you. And every man on the Central Committee of the NJP, this is one of the beautiful things about it, and it's very refreshing to work with all these guys. Every guy on it doesn't want to do either of those mistakes, either of those pitfalls. We have no intention of playing dress up and acting like some kind of weird cult and using language and symbols that alienate people. We want to win people over, but at the same time, we have no intention. We refuse, as a matter of principle, to pander to people or to try to ingratiate ourselves in a dishonest way with people. We have to be honest. We have to tell the truth, but we have to tell it in a way that we can get through to people. So that's what we're trying to do with it. And that's where the National Justice Party, I feel like, has broken out of this false dichotomy of amnat, wignat, you know, good optics, bad optics, whatever, purity spiraling. We've broken out of that. And the other thing is, John, we are not focused on this movement. We are not focused on the little dramas and the petty, you know, online fights and the little subcultural eccentricities. We want to keep our message focused on the broad masses of the white America. And that's hard to do sometimes, because if you spend a lot of time on the internet, you get into all these hot takes and deep, big-brained analysis and, you know, like you're seeing a take within a take within a take and layering the nuance onto things. And, you know, because we all are political junkies. So we all spend a lot of time on Twitter or on Telegram listening to podcasts or creating podcasts. So there's a tendency to go down this rabbit hole of ever more esoteric or obscure or, you know, just hot takes, some kind of unorthodox way of looking at things, because the plain, simple appeal to the great mass of American, normal American whites is like boring. You know, it's not as interesting. It's like an old, it's a cold take or whatever. But that's the other thing. We are trying to really orient ourselves so we're not just talking to our guys. We're not just talking to our movement. I don't know if you saw my speech I gave at the last big event we did. I called it a message to the left, but I was making the pitch to the ex-Bernie voters. And right now, Mike, just his speech is really a pitch aimed at disgruntled Trump voters. That's who we want to reach. We want to bring new people into this thing and not just keep talking to ourselves.
Yeah. No, I think that's very good. I think that's a very good strategy to take. And also to avoid the gossip and the drama, which has plagued I think really just sort of alternative politics in general, and just that also kind of comes with all these, you know, anonymous people on the internet just sitting around in chat rooms or forums or whatever, gossiping and making accusations and creating drama. And I also think there's probably state actors involved in that as well. So I think be a good strategy just to avoid that sort of mindset, which, as I mentioned, has plagued the movement since I've been involved with it anyways. So that's very good. Yeah.
We've all been doing this long enough that we're just sick of it. I mean, none of us have any tolerance for that at all. It's one of those things that when we see it, it's just, we shut it down. We don't engage with it. We block it, or we just, you know, cut it out of our field of vision, because it's completely, I mean, there's us and then there's the people who run the country. And really, that's who our fight is against. Like, I mean, what did you think of the Capitol peaceful protesters on January 6th? It's funny, because going into that, I was thinking, oh, look at these people. These are, what a joke, you know, a bunch of misled, stop the steal Trump people who are still following that Zionist. And I really didn't think, you know, these are not people who are, a lot of them are even pro-Israel because they've been listening to Trump's lies. And a lot of them are not, certainly they're not consciously pro-white. And, they're being misled, I thought, by a lot of grifters and hucksters and people like Rudy Giuliani, really shady characters who are just sort of feeding them a line. But man, the events of that day, by the end of that day, I was with those people heart and soul. I mean, as far as it was just like a spontaneous, kind of a popular uprising.
Yeah.
And without any violence, really. I mean, all the deaths, and Mike talked about it in his speech, the deaths were caused by the extreme use of chemical agents by the security forces. And in Ashley Babbitt's case, she was just shot, you know, executed. But, it was not a riot. It was not let alone a terrorist attack. And it really, like, that spirit that those people had, that mischievous, just like thumbing your nose at the powerful, and the just general like sickness of these lying politicians feeding the same lines of bullshit to the people, that just their lives get worse and worse every year. That kind of cheerful protesting against that, and how far they got, because I don't think anybody expected that they would be walking, the guy would be sitting in Nancy Pelosi's office. And that's why the system's coming so hard on those people, down so hard,
yeah,
on them, because it embarrassed them. It embarrassed them. It made them look like the paper tiger that they are. But I love that.
Yeah, you guys had a great article on NationalJusticeParty.com posted the day after. The NJP stands in solidarity with the uprising of January 6th.
And I wrote the first draft of that, and then Mike reworked it. But, oh yeah, a lot of that was mine.
No, yeah, and I totally sympathize with the spirit of it. I think it's – I sort of have a nuanced take on it, I guess, because I have seen some evidence that there were some bad actors involved with it, or what appear to be bad actors, and by that I mean agent provocateurs maybe. I think
– possible.
Yeah, I think that maybe some of the law enforcement involved were standing down and sort of letting this media spectacle happen. And certainly we see in the aftermath, it has been used to justify this extreme crackdown. I mean, we saw all the troops in the Capitol for the fake inauguration. So it's certainly the event is certainly being used by the powers that be to continue to perpetuate this anti-white agenda and the demonization of just white people in general. Like, anybody that's a nationalist or a populist or even a Trump supporter is now like a terrorist in their eyes.
It's insane, and it's so ridiculous.
It absolutely is. And these are the same damn people who are praising Black Lives Matter, literally burning and looting and destroying entire cities, robbing people, killing people. They have nothing but praise for these people. And then, you know, what happens at the Capitol? It's like, you know, a national travesty or something, according to these people. It's so sickening. So, I mean, just for that alone, you know, I do support, and I think the vast majority of the people that were there, at least this is what I can tell based on observation of the video footage I've seen, and also from some firsthand accounts. There was a good article on theoccidentalobserver.net shortly afterwards of somebody who was there and sort of gave a really good you know, just explanation of her experience at this event. And I think the vast majority of people there, I totally sympathize with their anger and their frustration and their outrage at what's going on politically.
Yes, absolutely. And I have a number of friends who were there, were just outside the Capitol building. And I had one friend tell me that he heard in the space of 1 hour, like three times, the protesters sung the national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner. And then he said multiple times, like 5 or 6 times, he overheard people saying, you know, is there a trash can around? Is there a place I can throw out my trash, my bottle of water, whatever? And he even heard one Capitol Police officer tell them, oh, good luck, because we took all the trash cans out. You know, they do that if they say you can't use trash cans as a weapon. But I mean, what kind of riot, let alone terrorist attack, is it where the people involved are they don't want to throw their trash on the ground? And Mike said, you know, they stayed in his speech. He says they walked in, they stayed within the rope lines in the Capitol building when they went in through. I mean, the idea that this was a attack or a riot or an angry mob, you know, it's funny. They didn't use
or an
the word.
Insurrection. They're calling it an insurrection. Yeah, that's probably the worst. That's probably the worst descriptor of it all, of them all.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, just the term mob is a term that we did not see that word used once by the mainstream media at any point during the summer with these, like, they weren't just mobs. They were ravening hordes of just burning, looting savages, smashing out stores. I mean, there was nothing of the kind with this. And, you know, what kind of a terrorist attack? Are they singing the national anthem and trying to, like, find trash cans to throw away their trash? It's just so insanely ridiculous. And the other thing, I made this point that the people flooding into the Capitol building were carrying the flag that's sitting on top of the Capitol building. So, you know, if you compare that to, because they say they stormed the Capitol, we'll compare that to, you know, the Soviet storming of the Reichstag. Like, imagine if the Soviets stormed the Reichstag building and then when they got to the top, they hoisted the swastika flag. Like, that wouldn't make any sense. You would say, okay, well, there hasn't really been a change. You know, this is just, these are Nazis in their own building. If the SS had taken the building back from the Soviets, they would have hoisted the swastika flag. So when you see people storming the Capitol building, carrying the same patriotic flag, the flag of the country that's on top of the building, that should be some indication that this is a loyalist crowd, that this is not a insurrection. These are not people trying to, like the, even the Confederates, this is not a civil war. This is people who are loyal to the nation and the idea of the nation and of patriotism, and they feel that the people they are protesting against have sabotaged it and have taken control of it, like mutineers, you know? And they're trying to restore the loyal patriotic authority. So, and like I said, there was not even any violence. I mean, it was people playing jokes and making, you know, somebody dressed in a goofy costume or a guy, an old man, puts his feet up on Nancy Pelosi's desk and grins. But like I said, I felt that, I mean, all of us in the NJP were just totally felt just thrilled by those people and what they did and how just enthusiastic they were. And we all felt also very protective of them, the way they were. And we're going to be talking a lot more about this, following the stories of these individual people who've been rounded up by the FBI and others, but and the Justice Department. But how these people have been completely abandoned by their Republican leaders. I saw Rudy Giuliani on television. I mean, the people I'm with, like the TRS crowd, you know, we wouldn't get within a mile of a Trump thing because we don't like Trump anymore and we think he's a bad person and he misled a lot of people. But there are those who were at Charlottesville who were part of the alt-right, like Nick Fuentes, who with the Groypers, they were there. They were there in force to support President Trump. And that's fine. But what's not fine is that Rudy Giuliani tried to pin the violence that did occur, which there wasn't that much of it, but he tried to pin it on them. He tried to say that they came there to start the violence because they hate President Trump because he's pro-Israel. I mean, here is like the one faction of the alt-right that stayed loyal to Trump through all his double dealing and treachery and betrayals and all the times he left our people in the lurch and all the, you know, the platinum plan, big giveaway to blacks and the sugar and spice and the, you know, African American unemployment and giving all these giveaways to Israel. It's like he managed to burn and drive away all of his most loyal supporters in the alt-right, except for one faction, the Groypers. And how does he repay that? His right hand, Giuliani, goes out to denounce them and make them the scapegoats. And that has serious repercussions because we're talking about charges filed for insurrection. I mean, this is heavy prison terms. You know what I mean? So it's not just like he's saying, oh, the Groypers made us look bad. Rudy Giuliani's saying, no, the Groypers caused the riot. The Groypers are responsible for the violence. And he's a lawyer and a former prosecutor. So it's like Justice Department, FBI, go prosecute the Groypers. And I will not, I mean, I can't even, John, I can't even imagine how a person could be that disloyal and just dishonest. It's treacherousness on a level that is difficult for me to even comprehend.
Oh, yeah, it's disgraceful. Well, and Giuliani was also denouncing them as anti-Semites. And, right. And I don't know if he actually referred to them as neo-Nazis, but he definitely called them anti-Semites and, you know, they hate Israel and stuff like that.
Michelle Malkin is aligned with them. I mean, Michelle Malkin is aligned with them, and she has a Jewish husband. So it's like here's a Filipino woman with a Jewish husband who has said a few good words about the Groypers and the America First movement, to her credit, and now you're going to throw her under the bus too. She's also a terrorist, you know, and an insurrectionist who's there to. I mean, it's maddening the way these people will act to save their own skin. But the point I'm making is that for the people like Richard Barnett, Vigo, who Mike mentioned in his speech, and others who were just regular people, and a lot of ex-military were represented there, like Ashley Babbitt. For those regular people who just thought they were doing right by their president, I know I speak for the entire NJP leadership when I say we have nothing but sympathy for those people and nothing but solidarity for those people. And if there's anything we can do for them, we're going to look because we're a small group and our resources are stretched pretty thin. But I certainly want to champion these people, their rights, their causes, and make sure that they don't get railroaded when you have people, scumbag traitors like Giuliani, just completely throwing them to the wolves and abandoning them, and along with the whole rest of the Republican Party. I mean, somebody has to stand up for those people. And that's the kind of thing that we can do with the NJP, is stand up for the little guy. Even if they were supporting President Trump when we were not, who cares? Who cares? They were there for the right reasons. Their hearts were in the right place. They're good people. They're our people. And they don't deserve what the DOJ and the FBI are doing to them right now.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And probably the most despicable one of them all is President Trump himself, who I think you could make a strong argument sort of instigated this with his speech and a lot of his rhetoric leading up to it. I mean, he was the one calling all of his supporters to come to D.C. that day in a rally that he described would be wild, and implored them to march down Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol. He was going to be with them, he said. So I think Trump played a key role in all of this. And as always, he has totally sold out everybody. And if you think about it, back when he was running, he was almost better running as a candidate in 2015 and 2016 than he was as a president, and certainly in the last year of his presidency. I mean, we went from building a wall, deporting them all, America First foreign policy, ending the wars, you know, correcting these trade deals with China and all these other countries, to, as you mentioned, like the platinum plan he's running on in 2020. He's running on moving the embassy to Jerusalem. I mean, it's a total 180, and he's been like this the entire time, is a sad thing. He's really been a total failure.
Yeah, it's weird because it's like I don't believe in Trump, but I believe in the people who supported Trump. You know
right.
what I mean?
Oh, yeah. No, like, and I agree. I totally agree.
And it's a hard thing because they still, a lot of them still believe in Trump. And I feel like there's something going on there where this isn't just, those people are stupid. Those people are morons. Those people have been misled and they refuse to wake up. We all know people, I'm sure, family members, coworkers, friends, who still defend Donald Trump and still feel like Trump's their guy, even after this. And I'll tell you, a lot of those people, it's weird, John. It's like they have been so starved of leadership for so long it's almost like an abused or neglected child. Like they have had, it's been so long since anyone has been shown them the slightest bit of kindness, the slightest bit of decency. It's like someone who, you know, is just an abused, neglected person who has never known love or kindness or support or strength. And someone comes along and pretends to offer those things in order to use them. And they've just earned that person's undying loyalty as a result. That person would die for this person who's the only one who ever showed them any sympathy or kindness or help in any way, even though that person was manipulating them. And if you pointed out to them 100 different times, like that person was just trying to use you, you know, they saw you were vulnerable and they were trying to use you, to benefit themselves, and they really don't care about you, and they really, you know, you can't win those people over by telling them that, because they are in such a position of just abuse and neglect from the people who should be taking care of them or watching their back. I mean, we're talking about Americans who go to school, go to work, you know, go to war, and they just do what they're told. They do what they're supposed to do. They pay their freaking taxes. They try to live like they get a loan to buy a house. They try to pay off the loan. They try to, you know, they get student debts. They go to college because you're supposed to go to college. You know, they graduate with good grades because that's what you're supposed to do. They try to pay down their debts. They try to start a family. They try to hold on to their marriage, their failing marriages. They try to, you know, steer their kids right, even though they're falling victim to drug abuse. They're just trying to do the right thing. And regular people trying to do the right thing, the people who run this country, the government, you're supposed to watch out for those people. You're supposed to look out for them and make sure that if they play by the rules and they do the right thing, that they can have a better life for themselves. Or at least they're not going to have all these terrible things happening to them. But these people have not had that in generations. And it's gotten worse and worse and worse. They didn't have it under Reagan. They really didn't have it under Clinton or either of the Bushes. They didn't have it under Obama, and they didn't have it under Trump. So Trump comes along and sweet-talks them and pretends like he cares about them, and they are clinging to that with a kind of a loyalty that is difficult to fathom unless you understand it in the context of like an abuse victim. And the way that you wake that person up, you don't really wake that person up. The only thing you can do for that person, though, is to treat them right, fight for them, and give them the kind of leadership that they actually have deserved all along, which is hard. It's much easier to say, oh, you're just a dumb boomer, you're just a stupid maggotard, and you're an idiot, and I'm here over here listening to my cool podcasts and hot takes, and I'm on Twitter, and I've got a big brain. I saw Trump was a phony and a liar years ago, and you're still on that Trump train, you idiot. Like, that's not what you do. That's easy to say. It's easy to be a jerk and rub that in people's faces. But these are hardworking, simple people that they don't have time to listen to or they don't have the inclination even to listen to podcasts endlessly or go in these deep dives. It's just not in their personality. And if it was, they wouldn't be the regular, normal working people that are the backbone of this whole country. So what I'm saying is the hard thing to do with those people is the thing we have to do, which is be patient with them. Understand why they're so loyal to Trump. Don't insult them. Don't demean them. But give them something better. Build something better for them. Show them real leadership and stand up for them when they need it. Like right now when Trump's abandoned them. And that's why the NJP's taken the position we've taken. Because we will stand up for these people now. Now that Trump has abandoned them, we will be their champions to the best of our ability.
Yeah, man. Well said. And, you know, I think it goes to show you that America, the bedrock of America, white America, has been so starved for leadership and for genuineness. And I think Trump, as an actor, put on a very good show and was able to convince a lot of people. And I got to tip my hat to him. He did put on a good show. I mean, he said a lot of good things. I think at the end of the day, from my analysis anyways, he was largely a failure. The only good thing I really see coming out of this is he's discredited the media in a major, major way. And I think that's a very positive thing, because I think prior to Trump, I mean, the media was basically, you know, nobody was really questioning the media, at least mainstream society in general. I mean, there's, you know, people on the fringes like us, you know, in the alternative media, but generally speaking, I mean, Republicans were watching Fox News and the Democrats were, you know, MSNBC and CNN. Now, most Trump supporters, most GOP supporters have totally lost faith in the media, which is a very good thing, and I think will make our cause much easier to sort of recruit these types of people. So I think that really that's the silver lining with Trump leaving the political stage. And who knows, he might still be around in the background. There's been talk of him. You know, who knows what he's going to do at this point. I frankly don't care. I'm glad that he's out of the way at this point, and we can really see how anti-American, anti-white the system really is going to be under Biden and Kamala Harris.
Yeah, it's funny. I try not to personalize politics. So while I am disgusted with Trump, you know, it's not personal. I knew when I was supporting him that there's a very good chance that he's being opportunistic. I didn't think he had a genuine, cause I told you and I've told this story before, but when I was with Pat Buchanan's, campaign right out of high school in the year 2000, Trump was showing an interest in getting involved in the Reform Party, campaigning against him. And there's this famous quote, he went on Meet the Press, and he said that he denounced Buchanan as a Hitler lover, an anti-Semite. He said he doesn't like the blacks. He doesn't like the gays. He said that he can't imagine why anyone would support him. And he said that he said it's an extreme right. And then he corrected himself. He says, I don't think it's even an extreme right vote. It's just a wacko vote. These are wackos that would support a guy like that. So Trump, I always did not like Trump. From that experience, that was my first brush with Trump in politics. And after that, you know, it wasn't until 2015 that suddenly, all of a sudden, he's talking about immigration and he seems to be flirting with this. And I have this whole theory that I've told before that I think Trump, he was soundly defeated in his attempt to take control of the Reform Party by the Buchanan Brigades. And the Buchanan Brigades were filled with nationalists, National Socialists, people who were, you know, politically anti-Semitic, in terms of opposing, you know, knowing about Jewish power and opposing it. These people were absolutely devoted to Pat Buchanan. I mean, they would just die for Pat. Go, Pat, go. And I think Trump saw that, and he was shocked by it. He was taken aback by it, because with all his celebrity and fame and money, he couldn't even make a dent in those people. And I think he recognized, because Trump, if you read The Art of the Deal, Trump has always been very good at spotting, he did this a lot in Manhattan, a good deal. He's good at spotting an undervalued property, a piece of property that he can pick up at a steal and turn it into something really great. And I think he has an instinct for that, and he correctly spotted that there is an untapped source of political strength in this country by taking the forbidden combination of nationalism and populism and mixing them. It's forbidden by all the powers that be. The political class just knows it's like a Pandora's box. You just don't go there. You don't touch that. Because it's one of those things, it's like, you know, it's against the rules of war for the political class. So if you're a Democrat or a Republican, you don't tap into that. Because if you do, who knows what it's going to lead to. Trump, though, being the brash Queens guy who likes to just offend the Manhattan blue bloods, that's the type of guy he is. He's always liked to be – he's always been in the class of the super rich, but he likes to be the maverick, offend their sensibilities, and kind of break the rules. So Trump, I think, realized – because he also was a big fan of Jesse Ventura and was friends with him when Jesse ran his big, very unorthodox campaign for Minnesota governor, and he won. Trump learned from that, and he was just like, okay, I'm going to tap into these nationalists, these racists. I'm going to tap into them because they are fanatics. They'll go to the ends of the earth for me, and there's a huge, you know, behind them, the activists, there's an enormous well of untapped white working class angst and anger over the way this country's being run. It's like a deal that no one's buying it, and I can pick it up at a steal. All I have to do is throw them some red meat, and I'll have those people for life, and I can ride that right into the White House. I mean, I don't know that he was completely that cynical. I'm sure Trump has some kind of beliefs about something with America, but it's all tied up with himself and his family. But I do think that that's the political calculation that he made. So to your point, I take the bad with the good with Trump. I never viewed him as the big savior and the God emperor. I was always suspicious of his motives, but I certainly thought that his campaign was good. I was voted for him. I was for his presidency. And, now that he's gone, yeah, we got to pick up what was good about Trump without, you know, too much resentment. I mean, like I said, it's not personal for me. We have a job to do of turning this country around, getting these bad people out. And, if Trump, for his own reasons, helped that process along, then we just got to make the best of it. And the same thing goes for all the other people in office right now. Like Biden. Biden's going to be really good for our movement. I mean, he's going to be really good for us, because how can we have infighting and division when this creep is in office? I mean, we have to unify. We have to get all unite, because there's no other way right now.
Yeah.
So
how can
use Biden too.
Yeah, no, I hear you. How can they continue to carry on about white privilege when his entire cabinet is all Jews? People are going to have their eyes opened, I think. I hope anyways, because it's just
like a naked Jewish dictator.
It's insane. I mean, it's almost like unbelievable, frankly. I mean, it's like you know the Jews are basically running everything, but really have every single last position. An ethnic Jew, and then the Jewish media, like the Forward and the Jewish Telegraph Agency, are like writing articles boasting about it.
I think even the most wild-eyed anti-Semites have been taken aback by
Jewish
the Biden administration is. And you know, John, it reminds me of something I mentioned. I'm interested in Hungarian history. We all know about the communist regime in Hungary after the war. And you know, the revolution in 56, it briefly overthrew them for like a month. But what a lot of people don't realize is that there was another communist dictatorship in Hungary back in the 20s, right after World War I, briefly. There was a Bolshevik regime that took power, led by a man named Béla Kun. In fact, Antelope Hill, I want to plug them because they're good friends of mine, Antelope Hill, the book publishing company, just published a memoir of a person who lived through that time. But they instituted a Red Terror in Hungary very briefly in like 1920, and then they were kicked out by right-wing forces that then turned into Admiral Horthy's government, anyway, who allied with Hitler during World War II. Anyway, the thing that I remember reading this, there's a book called I forget the name of it. It's something about fascism. The Anatomy of Fascism. It's by one of these sociologists who's like a leftist, and he's like, oh, let's study fascism, this pathology, and let's examine it. And I remember it was in that book where they're sort of pathologizing fascism that this guy was forced to admit that something like two-thirds of the ruling government of this Béla Kun's Red Terror government in 1920s Hungary, two-thirds of the leading members were Jewish, which is funny because Hungarians are like a people who just – they take in anti-Semitism with their mother's milk, like a lot of East Europeans. But they've had such a rotten experience with Jews for so many decades and centuries that they just – it's just – Jido is how you say it in Hungarian. But the point is, this is like – what we're seeing with Biden is like some kind of Red Terror regime. I mean, it's like some kind of – Judeo-Bolshevik Red Terror. It's really tragic and funny at the same time. You know, it's something that I will say this. I'm glad that the Reds of this time are a lot less have a lot less testosterone than the ones of that time.
Yes,
I'm glad we're not dealing with a bunch of ex-World War I soldiers or you know, like brutal Russians like Marshal Zhukov and people like that. Those are the Bolsheviks of those days. Today we have people like this Levine, the tranny that looks like some kind of a demon, and these various bugmen and nerdy Jews like Jonathan Greenblatt. So they're just as nefarious and they're just as bad. They're just not quite as menacing as I think the Bolsheviks of the last century.
Yeah, exactly. Well, hey, man, this has been a great conversation. We'll go ahead and wrap it up. It's been well over an hour, so thank you very much for taking the time. I do appreciate it. And it's been great to connect, and maybe we can do this again in the future.
I'd love to, John. Like I said, it's great to you struck me as someone, even when I first met you, you're someone that you have a very positive glow about you. You're always smiling, and you just have a really good attitude, positive attitude. So, and I remembered that about you. And so, yeah, it was great to reconnect, and I really enjoyed it.
Great. Well, thanks, man. We'll stay in touch, and thanks again for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Take care, man.